From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and in a matter of hours, we're going to have the first clues about what's going to happen in this historic midterm election. Even before the polls opened this morning, a record number of early ballots had been cast. At stake is control of the House of Representatives, the Senate, and numerous governorships, as well as state and local races across the country, and a number of ballot measures. Today, long lines are being reported at polling places across the country, despite severe weather on the East Coast and snow in the Northern Rockies. Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Happy Election Day.
Happy Election Day. And what's your sense of turnout today?
Well, you hear the anecdotal stories earlier in the day, and it's hard to put that into terms, in terms of numbers. Certainly a lot of pictures of long lines, a lot of people talking about long lines. But those early voting numbers you mentioned are pretty interesting. About 36 million people voted early, and a significant percentage of people who did vote early didn't vote at all in 2014. Mm. So there's always a conversation about how much stock should you put in early voting, or people just changing their habits, and they seem to over time. But the fact that a pretty big chunk of people who didn't vote at all at the last midterm showed up and voted early is a good sign that it's going to be higher than usual turnout in this midterm election, likely.
Now, we'll start to get the first results early this evening. What are you going to be watching for on the earlier side to find out whether this is going to be a good night for Democrats or Republicans?
Three key races that close in the first few hours, one in Kentucky, two in Virginia. The Kentucky race is a pretty heavily Republican district where incumbent Republican is Andy Barr. He's running against one of these candidates that really typifies the Democratic field this year, Amy McGrath. She's a combat fighter pilot veteran and one of those Democrats who really went viral, raised a ton of money from around the country, and is a first-time candidate playing up military background and a woman running as a Democrat. So if she's hanging in there or ahead of Andy Barr early on, that's a sign that things are going to go well for Democrats. And then two Virginia seats that are in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. These are kind of easier seats for Democrats to pick off. Dave Bratt's district and Barbara Comstock's district. Those are the two Republican incumbents. They're both running against women. So many of the Democrats running on the ballot this year are women. Abigail Spanberger and Jennifer Wexton are the Democratic candidates there. So I'm going to be keeping an eye on those three districts. If we're a couple hours into results and Democrats are ahead in all three, that's a really good indication Democrats are going to have a good evening.
Okay. And the conventional wisdom at this point is that Democrats have a good chance of retaking control of the House, but that the Senate is much more difficult. Is it possible, as you look at the races that are out there, for the Democrats to have a really good night and take back both the House and the Senate?
It's possible. A lot of people aren't predicting it, but there is a very narrow path to do that. And remember, this time 2 years ago, we were talking about the very narrow path that Donald Trump right. needed in order to become president. So it can happen. Democrats need to defend seats in 10 states that Trump carried in 2016. The interesting thing is most of those states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, seem to be easy defenses for Democrats compared to what they thought going into this election cycle. So if Democrats hold all the seats that they're defending, including real tough seats like North Dakota, Montana, and Indiana, and then pick off a couple seats in the Southwest, that's the way it could be possible.
What would be a very good night for Republicans? Or is it possible for them to hold both the House and the Senate?
Sure, that would be the best night for Republicans. But most Republicans I've been talking to the last few days are pretty resigned to losing the House of Representatives. And a good night for them is maintaining control of the Senate or maybe even adding a seat or two to their Senate majority.
So if the Democrats take the House, what does that mean for President Trump? What do you expect him to do?
A whole lot of investigations. Democrats have talked about wanting to pass measures right away on lowering costs for health care, on some sort of permanent status for people in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. But the biggest area that we'll see a shift right away is the fact that Democrats will be able to set the agenda and Democrats will be able to hold hearings investigating the Trump White House for a whole range of issues. Things like why the Trump administration really tried to undersell the Affordable Care Act or try to scale back key parts of it. And, of course, the Russia investigation. Democrats haven't really talked about Russia as much on the campaign trail, but it's out there. And you're going to see a much different House Intelligence Committee investigation into the Russia allegations, for instance, if Democrats are the ones calling the shots.
And what's going to be on the agenda if Republicans keep control?
That's a great question. We haven't heard too much about it because Republicans have just been playing defense for so long. But if President Trump comes back with a Republican House and Senate, I think one thing that you'll see is yet another conversation about repealing the Affordable Care Act or reassembling it in some way or another. Republicans have been on defense the last few weeks, especially saying that they do support protections right. for pre-existing condition coverage. But still, they ran for almost a decade on repealing Obamacare. And if they still have control, you have to imagine they would try again. I
just want to ask you one more thing quickly. A lot of sure. governor's races out there, and one that everybody's been watching is the one in Georgia. We might not know who the winner is for some time, because if one of the candidates doesn't get over 50%, there's going to be a runoff.
That's right. The Georgia and Florida governor's races are the two most interesting ones to me. And the good news is they both are on the earlier side in terms of when the polls close. So we'll be seeing those numbers early in the evening.
All right. We will be watching it and listening to you, Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, jury selection continues today in the trial of Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, a name that sent a chill through a swath of the world where his Sinaloa cartel allegedly conducted a murderous campaign of drug smuggling. The name is apparently also frightening at least one potential juror who was excused after she said she didn't feel safe. In addition to his alleged penchant for murder and retribution, Guzman has infamously escaped from prison twice. Brooklyn's federal court is heavily guarded with bomb-sniffing dogs, and the judge has decided the jury should stay anonymous or nominate. What does that mean? Adam Benforato is a professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law in Philadelphia, also the author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. So, Adam, we also had a potential juror say he would very much enjoy the El Chapo sandwich at his deli, but as we said, at least one feared for her safety. What if a lot of jurors say they don't feel safe and they're all being stared at during this jury selection by this defendant?
Well, I think it's quite common, actually, for jurors, even in a standard case, to feel anxiety about interactions with the defendant. Now, as a result of the Sixth Amendment, we ensure the right of the defendant to be in the room during voir dire, and in this case, you know, Mr. Guzman is sitting in the room as these jurors are being asked questions about their backgrounds and their biases. And so I think it's quite a reasonable response. Indeed, I would question the reasonableness of a juror who felt completely comfortable in those circumstances.
Well, given that, what do you do? I mean, the judge has made the jury anonymous. The names, the addresses, the places of employment of the prospective jurors won't be revealed. The panel will be transported to and from the courthouse, presumably from their homes, by U.S. Marshals and sequestered from the public. The public won't be able to see them while they're in the courthouse. And so let's talk about that for a second, because we understand the first time an anonymous jury was impaneled was in 1977, the trial of another drug kingpin, Leroy Barnes, in New York City. Apparently, there was fear that he or his operatives would try to jury tamper. And then, of course, there's the question of the safety of the jurors. What's the thinking about impaneling an anonymous jury?
Well, there's always a fear about lack of transparency in our system. We have deliberately taken steps over, a period of really centuries to have a system that the public can monitor. And so I think anonymous juries are always a fear for people who believe in our constitutional system. At the same time, the truth is there have been incidents of violence and intimidation against jurors, and I think that reality means that it really is a necessity in a case like this. I don't think there's any way around it, and the question is just simply how do we do it in a way that upholds the rights of the defendant to the greatest extent possible. But I think we always do the best knowing often that what we are doing is inadequate. Now, I'll give you an example. In yesterday's questioning of prospective jurors. One of the jurors mentioned that he was a Michael Jackson impersonator. And what did the judge do? Well, the judge said, well, that's, a potential concern, but left him in the pool. And to me, that's a real problem. How many Michael Jackson impersonators are there out in New York City? Not enough that preserves that man's anonymity.
Look, First Amendment scholars worry that this kind of anonymous juror that was usually for a dangerous gang case or terrorism has been extended to things like the trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich or the trial of George Zimmerman. that it's being misused. Others have said that another way to use anonymous juries is to keep them anonymous during the trial but release the names and information later. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think the benefits of that is that, you know, the accountability and transparency does come at some point, and journalists can go back over the details and uncover potential biases that may have been missed. The danger, obviously, in a case like this is the possibility of reprisal by a dangerous defendant. If the goal is really to protect people, I don't think that works to wait for a four-month trial to be over and then release the names. Certainly a violent drug gang may still want to send a message in future trials, in future cases. And so I think that it doesn't really address that concern.
That's Adam Benferrato, professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law. Professor Benferrato, Adam, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Torch Song Trilogy is back on Broadway now, Simply Torch Song and Simply Wonderful, Harvey Fierstein's hilarious and heart-smashing story of Arnold Beckoff, a young gay Jewish man looking for love, a family of his own, and bunny slippers, first debuted in 1982. Now we first meet Arnold as a heavily made-up preening drag queen talking to the audience as he dresses, played now by Michael Urey.
The person who thinks he's mature enough to handle an affair that's hopeless from the beginning is the same person who keeps the publishers of Gothic romance up to their tragic endings in Mink.
We watch as Arnold matures, has a relationship with a closeted, eventually married man named Ed, played by Ward Horton. They remain friends and later have a weekend getaway, Ed with his understanding wife, Laurel. Arnold comes with his new young love, Alan, except Ed and Arnold end up cuddling together.
I could have kept you.
You think so? In all my time with Laurel, I never cheated on her once. And believe me, our relationship allows for it.
If your relationship allows for it, then it's not cheating.
Are you making a pass at me?
Then, years later, we meet an older, wiser Arnold. He's fostering a troubled gay teen. Enter his overbearing mother, played by Mercedes Rule.
You talk to your brother?
Yeah, he was over for dinner last week.
Yeah, he bring a girl with him?
Ma hates Arnold's homosexuality. He's still mourning the recent death of Alan and thinks that maybe that loss will bridge the gap between them because, as he points out, his mom is mourning the loss of Daddy, her husband.
Oh, wait. Are you trying to compare my marriage to you and Alan? Your father and I were married for 35 years, had two children, and a wonderful life together. You have the nerve to compare yourself to that?
I'm talking about the loss.
What loss? What loss did you have? You fooled around with some boy.
Simmering rage explodes. It turns out Alan was beaten to death by kids with baseball bats. Kids like you, Arnold tells his mom as she storms out. We sat down with a much more relaxed Mercedes Rule and Michael Urey. They're both stage veterans, but still, this is Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song. Michael Urey, any trepidation about stepping into these? They're bigger shoes just because it's a bigger actor. Harvey, he's bigger. But any trepidation about stepping into those shoes?
Yes, because I knew the play. I'd read it in high school. But the idea that I would be Arnold was never on my radar. Really, when I first read it, Ed was the character that I most responded to because I was in Texas and 16, you know, and I thought that's more like me, I think.
Talk about that. Plano, Texas, Ed, who is bisexual, to put it one way, or ambivalent about being gay, the other, we're not quite sure.
Right.
And here you were in Plano, Texas, as I read somewhere, you were the kid in high school who could do a really great gay voice.
Right. I was in touch with this sort of feminine side of myself in great part because I wasn't gay, you know.
In your mind.
Right. Or according to anyone else. Because no one was. You know, that wasn't...
This is in the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but it was also kind of a lifetime ago. As I recall, there was one guy in my high school, which was enormous, who everyone knew was gay and who walked around with, you know, bright colors and was proud and heroic. And I remember thinking he was so much braver than I could have been. And so, you know, it was easier to do the gay voice, knowing that no one would think I was gay. And in fact, I remember distinctly this very popular girl who sat next to me in some class, would never be friends with me for real, but she thought I was very funny, saying to me, "You do that too well." And that sort of stuck with me. And it has continued. You know, it's something I've been thinking about a lot about lately, this idea that gay people are told not to be so big, not to be so flamboyant, don't be so soft.
Don't be yourself.
Don't be yourself. And, you know, when I got on TV on Ugly Betty, I was playing a very gay, flamboyant, effeminate character.
After work, let's meet at Prune, because if I don't get a parsley and dandelion salad, I swear to Barbara, I'm going to throw a fit with the fury of a thousand queens.
But I was unknown, so I had no problem going there. And there is something about once you're out.
You worried. You worried at a time that you were going to be typecast as a gay person. And as Harvey Fierstein shows, and as you demonstrate on stage, what does that mean? There's like a million versions of them.
I know. The idea that there's only one kind of gay person is such a small idea.
Mercedes Rule, playing Michael's mother. This woman is frightful in many ways because she just can't accept her own son. So how do you approach her?
Well, she simply doesn't think that homosexuality is socially or morally acceptable. That's how she was brought up to believe. And so the way into her and her attitude towards her son is that she's trying to get him to change for his own good so that he will be more comfortable in the world, that he might be able to have a family, get married, have children, have the good life that she has had. And he even says in the play, the life I want is the life she's had.
Do people say to you, who might see it now, this is impossible?
No. Interestingly enough, everybody sees not only is it possible, they see evidence of it everywhere. I mean, you know, there's still a great deal of homophobia.
When you do this intense scene, both of you at the end, you're having to walk away from someone you love, Mercedes, and your mother's turning her back.
Oh, I think we've reached out into some real pain. But, you know, she leaves, but I never feel like I'm leaving for good. Do you ever feel like
no.
I'm leaving for good?
No, not at all.
He's changed through the play, but so is she.
I was lucky. I didn't have the same experience that Arnold did. My parents were always really cool, and I have an older sister who's gay, and we got lucky. I don't think about myself in that scene so much as I think about people I know, or I think about other estrangements.
I try to love you for that, but you just won't let me. You've got to throw me in the gutter and rub my face in this. You have not said a sentence since I got here without the word gay in it.
Because it's who I am.
No. If that were all, you could stay in the bedroom where it belongs. No, you are obsessed with it. You're not happy unless everybody is talking about it. I don't know why you don't just wear a big sign and get it over.
All right, Ma, try to imagine the world the other way around. Try to imagine every book, every magazine, every TV show, every movie was trying to tell you that you should be homosexual.
Oh, please.
But you knew that you weren't. You knew that for you this was right.
No, stop. You're talking crazy.
No. What's crazy is that all these years I thought that justified my life to you.
I'm thinking, how many more people were your character, Mercedes, and now they may have changed, and they're maybe coming to see you. They're going to see themselves.
My own dad was one of them. My own dad was one of six, one girl, five boys, Irish cop, you know, Bronx. And the youngest is gay. In fact, he just came last week with his husband. I call them the Unks. They have glasses chiseled called the Unks. But my dad and his brothers were very, very hard on my uncle for a long time. But my father was the one who came around and realized he had I must have had an epiphany, actually. But he reconciled very lovingly with his brother, thank God, before he died, and really accepted him entirely.
So your father's in your character, too. I mean,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And how did your unks like it?
They adored it. They loved it. Yeah.
And for them to see some of their brother in you.
Yes. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
But something that Harvey said when we did it off-Broadway last year, is that when he took his mother to see the play for the first time, she said, "That's my mother." And for a long time, Harvey said this is about my mother and her mother.
If I'm not mistaken, too, Harvey's brother came, and he said to Harvey quietly, that really was Mom, wasn't it? Because while Mom was still alive, it was her mother. But Harvey said, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Quick question. Did Harvey Fierstein give you any advice?
Well, the first day of rehearsal, he said, if this play doesn't embarrass you, you're not doing it right. And this is what we do. We get up on stage and show our souls. So the idea that we would be embarrassed by that at first was surprising to me. I thought, why would this embarrass me? I signed up. You know, why would I be embarrassed by this? But I get it now. It's not putting on a dress. It's the scene with her. That's the scene that's the most embarrassing. And I realized it when it was, I think, a late preview in Off-Broadway. Two very close friends of mine who love me very much came. And when I thought about them watching me hear her say the things that she says, it destroyed me. And I was humiliated that they were seeing it. And that's when I realized what he was talking about.
Saying that you're kind of worth nothing. I mean,
well, yeah, but it's a sickness, you know, that you've chosen this for yourself, and that if I'd known, I wouldn't have bothered. And, you know,
having you
killed the father.
Yes.
Oh, and you're being gay killed your father. I think Mercedes' character says that, and then you land the thing that, oh my God, parents cannot take back. I wouldn't have had you.
Yeah. Which is. What is the most shocking thing to our audiences? I think when it was done back then, that wasn't surprising to people. It hits them over the head. When we pass each other backstage after the big fight scene, and we're beat.
We are beat. Sometimes we just hold each other for a second. Just for a second, in passing.
Mercedes Rule, Michael Urie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And they are in the critically acclaimed revival of Torch Song, now on Broadway.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did your employer give you paid time off to go vote today? If not, they might be missing out on a growing trend. A record 44% of U.S. firms are paying for their employees to go vote in the midterm elections today, up from 37% in 2016. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
And I voted. Hi, Jeremy.
I voted, too. So nearly half of employers are offering paid time off to go vote, according to a Bloomberg report citing data from the Society for Human Resource Management. What's behind that trend?
Well, so a few things. I think it's good to do. I think we've realized that, you know, after the 2014 midterms, there was a 72-year low in voter turnout. And a lot of people who don't vote, 35% of respondents in a Pew survey said they don't vote because of work or school conflict. So I think of the things that employers can do, and remember, employers are really battling to get millennial workers, who are about a quarter of the workforce now, who are interested in social issues. I think it's a good thing to do.
You know, a lot of people might be listening to you saying that and thinking, well, why don't they just have the election day on a weekend?
That'd be a really good idea, actually. America's one of the few countries that does election day on a weekday. It comes from our farming days. Most eligible voters were farmers and Christians. And so Sunday was out. Uh-huh. So you needed to travel a long time to get to the polls. So that's why Tuesday worked, because Wednesday was market day. But around the world, Sunday is actually the most common working day. A lot of people say that won't work in America for religious reasons and for practicality, but might not be a bad idea.
So some companies like Patagonia are taking it a step further and actually closing down on election day. What are other businesses doing to increase voter turnout?
Well, there are a lot of people who are offering things, incentives to people as a result of voting. Now, there's a federal law against giving people things of value for a particular vote, but you see a lot of companies, Uber, Lyft, a lot of these bike share companies are offering rides, discounts on rides to polling places. Mm-hmm. A number of companies are encouraging people to do things. You know, there's freebies all around at different companies. There's a sense of if you wear the I voted sticker, you should be rewarded for the idea that you voted. But again, it's not the laws are different all around the country. Some states allow you paid time off. Some states don't. Some places mean that you allow that you have to have a certain amount of consecutive time off to work. So I think the answer is if a lot of companies just do a better job of saying, hey, go out and vote, and this is how you can do it. It would be better. Patagonia is a smart company on a lot of levels, so it's in their DNA.
I was wearing the I voted sticker and walked around, and somebody waved at me, and I thought it must be because of the, it must not just be because of my smiling face, Allie. But let me ask you this. On the flip side, are there companies that punish people for taking time off to go and vote?
Nobody's advertising that they do. A lot of states actually have laws that allow people time off, but I don't think a lot of people know that. For instance, in New York and Colorado, you can actually lose your corporate charter if you stop somebody from voting. In Arizona, Missouri, and Kansas, you can face fines if you block someone, an employee, from working. I think it'd be a big PR problem if people said so. We've seen companies where the CEO has sent letters to people about who they're supporting in an election, which is also illegal. So I don't know a lot of examples of companies that have barred people from voting. The issue is a lot of Americans are employed by small businesses where they might be the only person in the shop or one of a few people. So it tends to be discouraged more than it's barred.
Mm-hmm. Allie Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thanks. Happy Election Day.
Thanks, Jeremy. You too.
When you buy tickets for concerts or plays or even movies, there are almost always fees attached. Handling fees, service fees, venue fees. Sometimes these added fees are clear, sometimes they're hidden, but they always increase the cost. Joining us to explain is Octavio Blanco, who's a writer for Consumer Reports. Octavio, welcome to Here and Now.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
And what are these fees for exactly?
So service fees essentially are what help companies like Ticketmaster to turn a profit. They're basically fees that get added on to the base price of whatever your ticket is, and it helps them to stay in business. But there's a lot more, as you mentioned, fees that get involved.
Like what?
So beyond the service fee, you have things like order processing fees or delivery fees or something called a facility charge. Facility charge, for example, is a fee that's set by the venue where the sports event or the concert is going to be taking place. And this is a fee that the venue gets 100% of. Then there's like order processing fees. You know, if you order something online, it's going to be easier for you than going to the actual ticket counter to buy your ticket. These order processing fees are avoidable, like I just mentioned, if you live close enough to maybe the venue or somewhere where they sell the tickets physically, and you just go there rather than ordering them online.
But you would think that it would be easier for them, the people selling you the tickets, if you don't have to go to somebody and pick up your ticket because they have to pay that person to give the ticket to you. Whereas if you're doing it online or on your phone, there's no. What's the service?
You know, it's one of these things that you end up paying for as a consumer, even though I live in New York City and I can just walk to the theater. It's not that much of a service for me. But if I live in, you know, Santa Fe and I want to go see a show, you know, somewhere else, that might be a service that I'm interested in.
But when you add up all those fees, when you start listing off all those fees, I think to myself, well, they could just easily add a Shirley fee or a Bob fee or, you know, whoever whatever they want. And they would get away with it at this point because we're so used to just, okay, fine, you know, it's going to be a little extra if I just pay the fees. That's fine. I already know that I want to buy the ticket.
Right. There are many added fees. We've seen that sometimes they can add up to 20% of the face value of a ticket. But there's also, you know, something to be said about what we might call a legitimate ticket seller versus a scammer. When people are selling really hot tickets, for example, they may be adding all kinds of fees. And so when those things are done in an unclear way, or when people are being shady about it, then that's when you start going into this idea of being scammed. And then there's also the idea of being, you know, just defrauded when you go and you purchase tickets from, you know, entities that you're not sure of, that aren't vetted, and you're not really sure whether or not the ticket that you're receiving is going to be, you know, a working ticket.
So maybe you're just paying a fee for the security of knowing that you're buying it from somebody who's actually selling you a ticket that will work.
I think so. I do think that it's important that, you know, you want to make sure that you understand as much as you can what the fees are going towards, and you want to make sure that they're within a limit that you feel is fair. And then you also want to make sure that the entity that's selling you this ticket, especially if you're doing it online or over the phone, is legitimate. So you want to look and make sure that they're part of a member association for ticket sellers. You want to make sure that there's other folks that you know of, or you can look up comments who have dealt with this company. You want to be wary of fly-by-night, people that don't have phone numbers where you can verify.
So I looked up tickets just now to an event on Ticketmaster that's coming up. A lot of people are excited about the new Elton John sort of finale tour. The tickets are going for, I mean, this is, you know, they're probably pretty good seats, going for $499 per ticket. And then if you buy two of them, there's $178 beyond that. It's $1,177 for two $499 tickets. Doesn't that seem like a lot to you for fees?
Ticket prices can get pretty high. I agree that it's often just amazing how much of the ticket price goes towards fees.
Well, then it makes me wonder. I mean, you're a Consumer Reports. As a consumer, if you are willing to pay a certain amount of money for a show, and then you find out when you're ready to purchase, you've already pressed, you know, yes, I want this. And then they come up and say, okay, but you have to pay this $30 fee per ticket or whatever. At what point would you decide, no, I'm not going to, forget it, I'll go out to dinner?
Right. Well, so look, the final decision for something like that is up to the consumer and what they can afford and what they can feel comfortable with. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of these fees are hidden, or at least they're not explained clearly enough at the time of the purchase. Now, Consumer Reports has a new action called What the Fee, where we're looking for people's reactions to being nickeled and dimed by fees. And we get a lot of complaints, not just on tickets to shows and sporting events, but airlines, cable. There's tons of fees that are being charged on us all the time, and that we don't get a clear idea of what it is that we're paying for. And consumers need to say that they're fed up. And if you feel like the price wasn't clearly explained to you, and then you get charged a fee at the very end, I think there's got to be a point where you say, no, this wasn't honest the way that this was presented to me, so I am not going to purchase this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is somebody like Elton John is not going to be on tour again, probably. And so
people will pay whatever it costs.
Exactly.
Right. It makes a lot of sense that your action is called What the Fee, also known as WTF in this situation.
Well, I think that's the question a lot of people have right at that moment when they have to pay.
That's Octavio Blanco, who's a writer for Consumer Reports. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on how Election Day is going in Tennessee. Blake Farmer is a reporter with Nashville Public Radio. He joins us from a polling place in South Nashville. Blake, what are you seeing there today?
Well, hey, Jeremy. It's fairly crowded for Tennessee. It's not a state known for turnout, but poll workers here at this elementary school say folks were lined up at about 40 minutes before the polls even opened this morning. People have been waiting, you know, 30 minutes or so to work their way to the front of the line, to the machines. And it's not just around here. Around the state, people are, you know, uploading photos of lines, you know, stretching out into parking lots, saying they've never seen this kind of activity, at least certainly for a midterm election.
And there's a big Senate race there to replace retiring Republican Senator Bob Corker. It's Marsha Blackburn, the Republican, against Phil Bredesen, the Democrat. Is that the race that voters there are paying attention to the most?
Oh, yeah. You know, Bredesen was a popular governor of the state, a Democrat, a centrist. Congressman Marsha Blackburn, the Republican in the race, has had, you know, a long career in Washington, but she is a known figure around the state. She often appears on talk shows. And, you know, even Republican voters that I've spoken to who voted for Blackburn say, you know, ultimately they considered Bredesen since he was so popular. But ultimately, for many, it really comes down to control of the Senate. And, you know, if you feel like you're voting for the Democrat, and that means you're voting for Democrats to take over the chamber, then you might vote for Blackburn, who, you know, is much more of a firebrand.
For some voters, it's been a long election season full of political ads. You spoke to one woman, Pat Majors, who is sick of the campaigning. Let's listen.
Their ads. Oh, I'm so glad they'll be over today. I have never in my life seen this much, you know. It's just been so ugly.
What else are you hearing from voters, Blake?
Well, the tone of the race is a common refrain. Tennessee hasn't had a race where there's so much outside money spent. Most of these ads from super PACs are certainly negative. I'm also hearing from voters that they're paying attention, and it's so obvious how someone is voting by what they bring up to me. You know, if it's the migrant caravan and the Kavanaugh hearings, then they're pulling the lever for Republicans. If it's health care, pre-existing conditions, expanding Medicaid in Tennessee, then it's, you know, it's likely Democrats.
Anything else that's big that Tennessee voters are voting on today?
Well, we've got a governor's race. It's not quite as competitive, but also a former mayor of Nashville, Carl Dean, is on the ballot, the Democrat in the race. Bill Lee is the Republican. He's a wealthy businessman. That race has not been quite as competitive, as mm-hmm. I say, and you could even tell it from the tone in the final spot. Bill Lee had this ad where he calls his opponent a good man and a public servant, so he holds a comfortable lead in the polls.
All right, Blake Farmer at Nashville Public Radio. Blake, thank you.
You're welcome.
And polls there in Tennessee close at 8 p.m. Eastern.
You know that year-long Amazon search for a second home outside Seattle? Well, it ended up a search for a second and third home, and not everyone is happy. Insiders say the Crystal City area of Arlington, Virginia, outside D.C., and Long Island City in Queens, New York, will split the 50,000 jobs Amazon promised. But as New Yorker Elizabeth Siles tweeted out, the thought of even 10 more people riding the 7 train to Queens makes me want to pass out. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ronnie Mulla is data editor at Recode. She covered Amazon search. And Ronnie, people think Queens in particular is already pretty saturated. What is Amazon saying about the split decision and the choices?
Amazon isn't saying anything yet, but what the reporting on this is saying is that it was such a difficult thing to find a city that could sort of handle 50,000 new employees and, you know, house them and, you know, handle the transportation and the infrastructure needs that would take. So it's being booked as the idea is that it's just a little bit easier on each of the cities if they split it down the middle, 25,000 people apiece.
Well, and people thought it was going to be the East Coast because Amazon has been able to hire thousands, will be able to hire thousands, and they couldn't do that in a rural area. But people in rural areas thought that they were going to have jobs brought there. So there's a lot of upset. And people point out that there are already workers in these two areas more than anywhere, but in Seattle and the Bay Area that work for Amazon. So it seems a little disingenuous to some people who are saying this whole thing was a PR event to leverage tax incentives from the competing cities. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, I definitely think it was an issue of going to a place that had a lot of tech workers that could work for Amazon as opposed to going to a place to give it tech jobs. Mm-hmm. And certainly that it's been – the whole contest has been done in this public forum. It makes it feel like a giant PR stunt.
Yeah. How big are those incentives, by the way?
We don't know. I mean, I think it's safe to say they're in the billions of dollars. Politicians really, really want Amazon to be in their cities. You saw this earlier on with the in the beginning and then with the 20 finalists. Those incentives that were made public were huge. And you know, they're just offering all sorts of stuff. You know, it's not always certain as to whether that the financial reward of getting Amazon will equal the incentives that these cities are offering.
Yeah. Well, and Amazon said it would invest more than $5 billion over almost two decades in one second headquarters. Now it's two. Hiring as many 50,000 full-time employees. Now that's split. Who would earn more than $100,000 a year on average. These are high-tech workers. These aren't people moving boxes.
Right. These are programmers.
Right.
A lot of them are. But there also is going to be a substantial number of just regular workers. They have warehouse workers. They've, you know, they have everything. But, you know, there will be a substantial number of programmers right. that make, on average, $110K a year.
So what does that do to housing in these two areas?
Well, obviously the prices are going to go up. You can't just add 25,000 new people and not expect that to happen. I wrote a piece earlier today that showed what the median housing price is in both of those areas, and I would definitely presume it would go up. One thing that's sort of interesting is Long Island City. They've sort of had this overbuild. There's been tons and tons of apartments built there, and that's created a surplus. So there is sort of some basis that would take these extra people. But in general, yes, expect housing prices and rental prices to go up. It's already a tight market in many places. And it's not just that people aren't going to just live in Long Island City. They're going to live maybe in the entire metro area, in Brooklyn, which is very packed, and the rents are going up.
Right.
Long Island, et cetera.
Right. I mean, you know, if anybody's been to that area, forget about it, as you say, for both housing and traffic. And what about Amazon's goal of doing this in a year? You're going to need 500,000 square feet of office space.
It depends on if they're leasing or if they're building new office space. I know in Long Island City that I think Citigroup recently announced that they were leaving there, and they have this huge tower. So that was going to be vacant. Long Island City in general hasn't traditionally been an office area. When I asked real estate people this morning, they sort of had to come up with a number for it because traditionally big office – big companies like that don't move there, and the ones that have sort of left.
Yeah. So here's another tweet from someone named Alan. He writes, so Amazon, famous for its ruthless pursuit of efficiency delivery systems, now thinks – but what if we congested one of New York's key subway choke points? You know, so people aren't happy. How is, in New York in particular, Governor Cuomo, who said, I'll change my name to Amazon Cuomo to get this deal. That seems like there's going to be some friction there with his own residents for a while.
Right. I mean, tech companies tend to be really divisive in the sense that, you know, they're making all of this money and then the people who live in those areas have to sort of pay for it in the sense that they have to pay rent and things like that. People are going to be mad, but it's also a mixed bag. They're going to get more amenities and there's going to be a lot of investment in their city. But, you know, I took the train here from Brooklyn and it's not great. We have the infrastructure in Long Island City is not great. There needs to be a lot of sort of government investment
upgrade
in order for this to be sustainable.
Right. Well, at least reporters don't have to keep tracking Jeff Bezos' corporate jet flight plan to see what cities he's going to.
We'll see.
Rani Mala, data editor at Recode, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.